You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Ever wanted to go to Florida for the winter but don't know where to start? We've got you covered. This month, we're talking about what Justine learned from attending an equine dissection, and if you have always wanted to try combined driving, we've got all the tips for you. One of the world's leading athletes is going to tell us all about it. Thanks for tuning in.
From Heels Down Mag, a podcast where horse pros chat about what's happening in the horse world over drinks. Welcome to Happy Hour.
I'm Justine Griffin.
I'm Jessica Payne.
And I'm Ellie Woznicka. Welcome to episode 145 of Heels Down Happy Hour.
Hi, everybody.
Hey, guys.
Are you guys surviving?
Sort of. Yeah. It's been cool, guys.
Yeah. I'm glad we're taping it this week, because last week I had no voice because I was down with the sickness.
I've been battling a cough. Really, I know. Used to this cold.
No, we're not used to the cold, and I have not been as bad as poor Justine, thank goodness. But like, this cough has like been lingering, and been taking my mom's like, you know, natural stuff. I think it's working, but I'm not sure some days.
Well, in the South, like, what the heck is this weather? We go from like extreme cold for a couple of weeks, and then it's like today was beautiful and almost 80 degrees, and it's going to be mid 80s for the next couple of days. And then it's going to be freaking in the 30s again on Tuesday. So
you can't decide. Poor Doug. Not poor Doug. He left me at home and I was in freezing. But at least when it was not above freezing, I didn't have to ride. He went to Ocala to show, and he was like, for 2 days, he said it was like a fog. And he said he was like blistering cold, wet. And he's like, it's Florida. They're not even used to this. Like, their pipes burst and everything else.
Yeah.
And
like, it was chaos. Yeah,
it's been a lot.
Well, we hit 50 today, guys. So
it's like August for you is what you're saying.
Yeah. You're like, this is amazing.
Yeah. This is our, you know, false spring. It'll get cold.
But I have
again,
a question. Does it melt and then you have problems, or you're just like still?
Yes. This will all be mud tomorrow. It's going to rain all day tomorrow, so it's just going to be mud.
That kind of feels gross. I almost want snow for you.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. Oh, I wasn't sure if you would agree or not, but I was like, that's what I would feel, but I don't know. I don't live that cold.
I prefer the cold. I don't do mud well.
Yeah, no.
So this episode is brought to you by Live Oak International. Okay, so I have a drink I think you will like, Ellie. Like, when I had this the other day, I was like, this is one that if I made it, I think Ellie would drink it.
Okay, I'm ready.
So, do you guys like Bloody Marys?
Depends on the day. I'm hit or miss. I feel like I have to be a little tipsy first.
Agreed. Like, it's not what I pick for myself, you know? So, what I have for you is called a Bloody Maria, and it is essentially a Bloody Mary, but with tequila. And it's actually really good. You don't even have to be a tequila person to like it. But basically, it's all the same ingredients that you would want in your Bloody Mary. Like, it's a tomato juice or a vegetable juice, lime juice, lemon juice, Worcester sauce, horseradish, hot sauce if you're really into spicy, celery, salt, and black pepper. And this recipe calls for silver tequila, but I have had it with different types of tequila, so I think it's like whatever you like. And basically, you combine all the things and you refrigerate it for a while. And then when you're ready to serve it, they recommend using a chili lime seasoning to rim your glasses, which I had never heard of that before, but it's really good. And when I Googled it, it's actually very easy to find. Like, most grocery stores carry it. But so it's kind of got like a spicy kick, but also like that tart taste from a lime, the seasoning that you use on the rim. It's really good. And then if you want to be fancy, you can like put a whole brunch in it like you can with a Bloody Mary. Like, you could put green olives, celery, shrimp, whatever you want, a slider. You know how like Bloody Marys come with like a full breakfast now sometimes?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
But yeah, it's pretty good. So for people who are not bubbly mimosa people, try a Bloody Maria sometime. We'll share the recipe in the show notes.
Sounds hearty.
Yes.
I could have this with some soup in the winter.
Absolutely. All right. Who has some news? Jess, are you ready to share?
I am. So I'm sad this year we will not be attending, but you guys, if you have not been to the Grand Prix Eventing Showcase at Bruce's Field, it is such a fun show. It's over a short period of days. they kind of condense it. They make it so that people can experience eventing like kind of in a shorter format, like a show jumping sort of situation where you can like sit there and see all the highlights. And everything is like super close in Aiken. Aiken's one of my favorite towns to go, but like you can go, it's Friday, Saturday of next week, the 27th, 28th. And I just can't wait to watch, like they'll live stream at places and everything else. But my favorite is just to walk around and see. You can walk by a bunch of the cross country jumps. It's kind of up close and you can kind of stay in a lot of places and see a lot of the jumps, which is super fun. So yeah, I was in Aiken this weekend visiting my mom and everybody was talking about the Aiken Grand Prix Eventing Showcase. And I am sad that I'm not going to be able to make it. But at the end of the day, if anybody else can, you guys take video and pictures and send it to us because I can't wait to see who wins it. It's always like a nail biter because they do the dressage on Friday morning. They do the show jumping Friday afternoon, and then they do reverse order of go. And so you can see like to the very end who wins.
I love reverse order of go.
I love it. It's my favorite.
I've always wanted to go, but I've streamed it. I've watched it. It just looks like one, a beautiful venue, and two, a nice time of year to be in Aiken.
I was going to say when the weather's not hopefully like what it's been like we were just talking about, hopefully they have good weather for the next weekend. But it's just, it's a fun place. Town's great. They've got a lot of good food restaurants and everything else. And my mom lives in Aiken. That's why we were just visiting her and stuff. But it's a fun town and you walk around town. They've got cute little shops and cute little restaurants. And it's a fun place to visit for us.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's fun. I'm excited to see like the list of who's competing this year.
I know. I don't even actually know who's competing this year. So I'm excited once they release that to find out.
Absolutely.
Ellie, what do you have for us?
Okay. I have news that I'm salty about.
Okay.
So the USEF talent search dropped the horse swap of the final four.
That's annoying.
Yeah. So for those of you who don't know, like the talent search is the four-phase format where they start with the flat and they had combined it to flat and gymnastics are one day. And then a full day of show jumping the next day in reverse order. And then the top four would ride off on each other's horses with the whole point of emphasizing classical equitation, technical precision, and adapting under pressure on different horses. So what? It's been like a decade since FEI did away with the final four rider swapping for in the world championships, and now USEF is doing the same thing with talent search. The traditional final four horse swapping write-off was like kind of the defining element of the competition, but now it's going to be replaced with something that basically is a jump-off. Like they're going to do top 10 horse rider combinations following the first three events are going to advance into like a modified winning round is what they called it.
Yes,
it's the like winning round.
And everybody doesn't, it's the number of people. Yeah, that's going to be interesting.
And it's a shortened, basically a shortened meter 15 course.
I mean, and now that just sounds boring.
Right?
Yeah.
So,
what the heck?
So the USEF managing director of the jumping, Lizzie Chesson, I believe is her last name. Like it's now going to be judged, right? To execute short turns, maintain control, and ride effectively while preserving classical form. I'm like, so basically it's just going to be a jump off. Like, okay.
But with like so judged on the eck a little bit, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. So they're kind of stressing that the adjustments reflect the shifts in international sport, that like swapping really hasn't been seen outside of the talent search since 2014 Alltech FEI World Equestrian Games in France. So it's been a long time. And they're like, oh, it's not to fix anything broken. They're just trying to keep the final relevant, keep it fresh, and keep the sport where it's going at the top level. But to be honest, I'm cranky.
Well, I feel like it shows more horsemanship and more skill to be able to hop on somebody else's horse and do the same course. You know,
100%.
You kind of see a lot of it.
Exactly. I don't think it matters that it's not quote unquote modern. I think it really is a test of the skill of the riders. So I'm just surprised by this.
Yeah, exactly. And they said that the major driver, right, is the increased importance of time at highest levels, right? So with Nation Cup finals now, if there's more than 8 teams, you're tied on faults. It goes to time. And I'm like, okay, so that's your reason for doing away with a swap? That makes no sense to me. Yeah. And they're saying they still want it to test the athlete's skill of jumping effectively and clear. Like, how can they execute a course with short turns while balancing position? I'm like, they've pretty much shown you that with show jumping. Like, a tighter turn, in my opinion, if you have good eck and good riding ability, it's not going to change because you did a little bit of a tighter rollback. Maybe that's a little too harsh, but like, I think it's bull manure.
Yeah.
I'm with you.
And Chesson even said, it's not about speed and it's not a horse race. It's about efficiency while riding. I'm like, okay. I don't know. So it's still going to have the flat and gymnastic components. And the gymnastic portion is still going to carry like additional weight in the scoring. But yeah, I'm pissed, to be quite honest. My brutally honest comment is, look, these people who are riding at this level are riding on really freaking expensive horses. And the fact that they can't swap to at least try to introduce another super broke, well-trained horse, you know, and try to at least liven it up a little bit with that, it feels pretty elitist to me, and I'm cranky.
To me, it just feels like we're dumbing it down so kids don't have to work as hard. I don't know.
Yeah.
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 I don't know. So, that's our hot takes for the
my cranky news. Yeah. Like, I mean, that was like one of like the biggest things that I enjoyed about, you know, college riding, right? Is that, totally, you know, an NCEA and IHSA, like the whole thing is the catch ride, you know? And it's just, it's frustrating to see that go away at top levels of the, you know, sport, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think a shortened course where, hey, you should probably ride a little faster, that doesn't show me as much as, can you ride this horse you've never ridden before? Go, you know?
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm with you. But I'm curious, like, I haven't read the comments or anything about this online, or like, I'm curious what the industry thinks. Like, are we in the, yeah, like, are we following the trend? Do most people feel this way, or do most people think, like, I wonder if it's like a logistics issue for USEF. You know what I mean? Like, is it just harder, yeah, to put that event on and have to deal with that portion of it? And maybe that's the like behind the scenes stuff we don't know, you know? Because it does seem like a major change for kind of a silly reason.
Yeah, I agree.
But who knows?
So do you have more exciting news, less cranky news? Just
yet? Right.
Yeah, this is kind of cool. I think it depends on like what end of the spectrum you're on this stuff, but it's in the same vein of another major horse show, the National Horse Show. I think it's the longest running and the oldest indoor horse show in the US. So obviously we know this is part of like the mainstay indoor series, but since COVID, I know that the horse show has changed venues a couple of times, but most recently has been held at the Kentucky Horse Park for a while now. I think since like 2011, it's been at the Kentucky Horse Park. But before then, it really, like, in its heyday, it was known for being in Madison Square Garden, yeah, in New York Madison City, Square obviously. Garden.
Yeah.
But they just announced that the National Horse Show is moving to Tryon.
I'm super excited.
The press release says pending USEF approval, but if they're announcing this in a press release, it sounds like it's pretty close to a done deal. So obviously, Tryon is in North Carolina, Western North Carolina. It's an amazing, beautiful venue. And I think the climate there, like, it's temperate even during, you know, indoor season. And they obviously have indoor rings there, but I think that's great. I know Tryon hosted a lot of maybe one or two of the different indoor series during COVID when everything, yep, was closed down. Do you remember that? Which was great. Like, they were able to keep those horse shows going despite the turmoil of the world at that time. And what a big win for Tryon to have.
Super excited.
Yeah. A horse show of that, with that history and of that quality, and to call it home and try on just sounds really cool. So I believe the 2026 schedule, the National Horse Show will take place in late October. I think it's October 21st to November 1st. What a beautiful time of year to be on Tryon. How beautiful.
Like, it'll be right before what I think will be the Duke shows.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, it'll be really nice. And
I'm excited.
Talk about world-class riders, you know, like you'll see the best of the best there. Yeah. And that seems just like a really great get for the venue for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we talked about how I was at home and the blizzard of what I felt like in North Carolina, but I did mention that Doug was freezing cold in Ocala, but I decided to bring him in because we do love the venue at Hits Ocala. He did get to go. Well, honestly, I didn't ride horses and he rode in what was pretty cold weather in Ocala.
The first 2 days.
The first 2 days he said was a foggy mist of coldness. He said he was.
The Ocala people were freaking out. Like their pipes froze and stuff.
I mean, it was legit. And I will tell you, our horses, we were able to ride, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of the week prior. And
it was not ideal.
It was not ideal. So I got down there and they were completely rogue. I wore my air vest to flat them the first day because
wow.
I was like, if I somehow don't turn into a lawn dart here, it's going to be a miracle. Somehow I managed to stay on top, but they were understandably, they were mental.
He had 15 horses and he said not one of them was okay. I go, well, mine looked really happy in their stalls. And he goes, yeah, because you didn't even have to take them outside. I was like, well, there was snow and ice. They didn't leave the barn. Mine were super happy. But anyways, Doug went down after the 2 days of freezing. He did manage. It was cold everywhere. It was cold in Wellington. It was cold everywhere. But he managed to finally get down there and show. And by Wednesday, it was Wednesday, Thursday, the better weather came in for showing wise.
No, Wednesday was freezing. Oh. By Thursday, got a little better. By Friday and the weekend was excellent again.
The sun returned, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Boy. No, it was wonderful. We love bringing the horses down to Hits, and it's a really chill, easy atmosphere. And for the young horses, for us, we've basically been trying to apply the model we used for event horses to jumpers. So we've been buying weanlings, try to do one a year. And so we always have a supply of babies coming up. And the great thing with Hits at all of their venues is age verified 7 and under, they get 3 classes for free if you've got the stabling. So it makes it way, way more affordable to develop horses and wonderful courses, good footing. It's
great.
A no brainer.
It's great because there are a lot of places that they do provide the young horse classes and it is cheaper to be in the young horse classes and they, you know, do have some prize money for the 6-7 year olds, but Hits does do something a little different. That they actually recognize not all horses can be at the level of what the age verification is. So like, you know, the 5, 6, and 7 year olds, what if you have a 5 year old that just came over and really needs to be jumping like the 80s? Well, that's not a 5 year old class. So they recognize it and say, look, if you stable on site and your horse is age verified, we'll give you 3 free classes to pick it. It doesn't have to be that they have to be at the level. And it's That's so cool. nice that we've taken horses that we got, you know, a little bit older and they didn't come up with us trying to do it, or they were less mature and all the different circumstances that we have utilized Hits a lot between Culpeper and Ocala that we've brought up a lot that weren't ready to just do their age verification. And like we had a hunter go last year and it's pretty spectacular there that they, you know, honor that.
Yeah, that's awesome. And they've done a lot of improvements to the venue in recent years. Like the arenas are really quite nice, the footing.
Yeah, the rings are great. So they're all Wordley Martin, so that the footing is wonderful. And they did also the main arena now at the Hits Ocala there has a sort of whole food court area right up next to the arena. And our kids love it because they've got kid jumps right there. So we can kind of just plant them there and they're off jumping while we're actually jumping, you know, a little bit bigger.
Well, and
sticks.
There's food. It used to be an old barn. So there used to be horses and everything else. Now it's like shut off that it's just people. There's tons of places to sit down, eat. They have like, you know, a brick oven pizza. They've got different restaurants. And you can sit there and watch outside. They have the VIP as well. But then if you're not in the VIP, there are so many places to watch the big Grand Prix arena right there.
And I feel like this, I mean, their winter season is packed. I know they just had, just last week, their world champion hunter rider week of competition.
Yes.
And that will continue again later in March. It's just, it's the best time of year to be in Ocala, and Hitz has got plenty to offer. When you guys come down and you bring the kids, maybe some client horses, where do you guys stay? Like, how do you build out your trip in Ocala?
Generally, so when Doug goes, we do have a friend that lives nearby.
Oh, nice.
I either do an Airbnb is generally where we stay. And then the kids can then come back and forth, you know, with school and everything else. But we either stay, the grooms, they have hookups at Hitz Ocala. So they've actually stayed on site, which is quite nice, in the RV. So we've done that, or we do an Airbnb, actually. So we do one of the two. So the grooms either stay on site, or we do a house for everybody.
Gotcha.
Okay. And so what do you guys like to do, like, around Ocala, outside of the horse show venues?
If we have time, generally we don't
that's
have
always the key question.
A lot of time. But honestly, we've taken a trip, like, Doug went and picked me up in Daytona one time I flew in.
Nice.
And we've done things like that. There are other things. There's good restaurants in Ocala.
There
They're
are.
Getting better and better.
It's come a long way. Yeah, in recent
come
years.
A long way and done that. We, well, long
I'll tell
time
you,
ago.
The other thing that works out well, too, is that the two venues between WEC and Hitz have, it seems, seemingly at least, working well together. So you could actually watch a Grand Prix at Hitz during the day and then go watch one at night at WEC.
Yeah.
And there's a ton of options in that way. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a ton of stuff to do.
There really is. And I mean, and you guys know plenty of people in town, I'm sure. But what I love about Hitz, like, even for eventers, there's an eventing venue right behind Hitz. It's called Barnstaple South. They host, like, mostly schooling shows, but good clinics and stuff, some young horse stuff. But when we're not in season, Hitz is so generous. And sometimes they allow the competitors at Barnstaple to, like, run the dressage on their footed arenas. And that's so nice. It really improves the experience, even for, like, a schooling show. Like, it's incredible to say I'm riding on the Hitz venue, you know, it's so cool.
Yeah. And they've been really generous too. My mom has been involved with USEA forever and ever, obviously, but she's one of the sort of instrumental people getting the young horse classes going for USEA. And they actually ran their symposium last weekend at Hitz.
Oh, cool.
And she said it was awesome. She said they had all of the spectators that came were in the VIP tent, and then they set up all the jumping exercises in that main arena.
I love that.
And Hitz donated that.
They donated the whole thing for that. So they're not just supporting the young horses, all this, the development. They're also supporting the eventing side of it.
Which the whole is community in Ocala.
The whole community. And it's awesome. And then what they also added, so what Doug doesn't mention is where we stable is we go to the stadium side. So there are so many different barns and everything else. For the last couple of years, we've actually gone to the stadium side. It's quieter. We can get our big rig in and the trailers can park over
there. It's a total hack too, because the barns themselves are nice and you can park the trailers right over in that area. So if you can store everything in the trailer, it's no big deal at all. It's be right next to your barn, and it's a pretty chill, low traffic.
And a lot of people don't like it because you're not on the main site, but all of ours hack really well. But what they have on that site is the old stadium that they used to have the Grand Prix and stuff before they fixed it. They have changed it into half show jumping, half hunters as a schooling day. And every day it's a ticketed schooling day. So if your horse is, you know, like Doug's were a bit wild and stuff, he decided to take a couple of the clients over and be like, hey, maybe we should jump. We haven't jumped in a couple of days because the weather. And they schooled on Tuesday over in that, you know, ring, or they can school in the other rings, or some of them didn't get in till Wednesday on show day. You can't get into the stabling or to the main show rings. They went into the stadium side.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's fun.
And it's open every day. It's awesome.
So I'm curious, because obviously I'm from the north, so I've only ever been to Hitz Hudson Valley and Hitz Vermont, but I love both of those venues. But I'm curious, like, how is Hitz Ocala compared to other Hitz venues you've tried around the country?
Yeah, so I grew up in Jersey, so we used to go to Saugerties all the time.
Yeah.
I would say from the barns to the ring would be a fair bit closer. And I mean, it depends exactly what barn you're in or whatever, yeah. But long story short, I think it's a bit closer. Saugerties, I haven't been there in a while, but they used to have that vendor row area and they have a similar setup at Hits. But I would say Hits Ocala would be, I don't know, seemingly more convenient. Basically everything's quite, you know, sort of quite close together.
I haven't been to Vermont.
Culpeper, you know, we showed there last year and we'll be going back again this year. You know, Culpeper feels a little bit more low key, but again, the quality of the ring courses, all that was great. And, you know, we'll definitely be back for sure. Yeah. The barns at Culpeper are awesome.
They redid them and the ventilation, we were in the center aisles and we were there in August in Virginia. I was like,
yeah, the stalls are huge.
Not sure we were going to make it. And honestly, it wasn't like it was a cool week. And they managed really well there. We were very impressed with Culpeper, okay, like in August.
Well, I mean, that's high praise.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so you guys, you've been to Hits this year. Doug, you've also been down to Wellington. I think for a lot of our listeners, like going to Florida to compete in the season is a dream, right? It's expensive. Yeah. It takes some planning. Yeah, for sure. But from your perspective, as someone who's done both and often does both in the same season, like, what are the biggest differences? What advice would you give to somebody who's trying to plan for a trip?
Why don't you break down what our thought process is?
So how we look at it is we typically go, this year we went first 3 weeks of January to Wellington. We did not bring the young horses because it's just, honestly, for the young horses, they don't have to do that much. You'll get them there through the year without a doubt. To be on track.
Sure, January is and not a problem.
Showing January is not a huge issue for them. And like we were talking about with Hits, it's just far more affordable to bring them there to develop than it is to Wellington. We would typically bring the more experienced horses to Wellington. And I think I always look at it more as a educational pursuit, really. We're going there, would love to compete. Obviously, it's great to get ribbons and, you know, grab a little bit of that prize money is awesome, but you couldn't bank on that. Honestly, the horse quality is just exceptional. It's probably among the best venues in the world for that. And I think going there, watching the best horses and riders in the world, it's if you choose to make the effort, just follow people and warm up. You can, it's a free lesson every single day, you know? And I think that aspect is wonderful. And we've got a great group of horses coming up, but we don't have any right the second that are supremely competitive at the top tier at the moment, but hopefully in a couple of years they'll be there, and which case we'll bring more down to Wellington. And then we'd look at Ocala a little bit more as a developmental path. So then we'd bring, you know, the young horses along, and for, you know, the bunch of clients that come, some go to Wellington, some come to Hits, some come to both. It's, you know, kind of pick and choose.
Based on their schedule.
Yeah, for sure. You know, Wellington's great. I, you know, absolutely love it. And in the middle of January, you might as well go as far south as you can, because Ocala in January still can be cold. So
he was complaining about February.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So if you're going to go south in January. But then, you know, by February, then it all becomes, you know, sort of equal across the board as far as conditions go, as far as weather and all that. But you might as well do all of it. Just pick one year to go one year to go another. And
or pick what you're wanting to do. Are you wanting the experience and you're just wanting to get in? Are you wanting a lesson? Like, I mean, it's just, we kind of vary it per year of what kind of, that's what we say to the clients even. We're like, we go to different venues depending on what horses we have at the time and what we kind of need to put them at.
Sure, for sure. Yeah, I mean, both of them are very different vibes, right?
And
it depends on your discipline, obviously. Like if you're an eventer, Ocala is where you should be, but
right
doesn't mean that there's not a lot to learn but that and said, see and enjoy the
the contrarian in me though is if you're eventing in January, you don't have to be doing any sort of crazy eventing in January. You don't have to be doing crazy fitness. You could go down there and make the most of the jumping scene there first couple weeks in January and be great. And I will tell you, it is great. Our daughter's born on January 3rd and she's like in the ocean, you know, on her birthday, which is pretty wild. And that's something that you wouldn't be able to get many places in the world.
Well, and also like just like Ocala, we talk about the different venues. Wellington has different opportunities that you don't have to be at one particular place. There sure. are places that you can school the young horses and do all that. So, you know, it's just kind of, we look at it like, what do we need that year? Doug loves, you know, we just try to utilize as much as we can for his benefit and my benefit for learning, that we go try to learn as much as we can in January to apply it for the rest of the year.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that sounds like a great plan.
Absolutely.
And it gets you out of the snow, even if it is absolutely. More cold.
100%. But it didn't get me out of the snow.
You can't handle it.
Yeah. Yeah, we can't. In February, I didn't get out of the snow in Florida, so it's okay.
Plan your 2026 competition schedule with one unmatched HITS experience across six premier venues, including HITS Ocala, HITS Del Mar, HITS Culpeper, HITS Chicago, HITS Hudson Valley, and HITS Vermont. Featuring seven total WCHR weeks, 10 total FEI jumping weeks, and opportunities for horses and riders of all levels from coast to coast, this action-packed year will be one to remember. Learn more at www.hitshorseshows.com.
All right, everybody. We're really excited to introduce our guest on this month's episode. It's Chester Weber, which is a name you should know because Chester is the most decorated driver in the United States. He has numerous accolades from over the years of combined driving, and he's related to Chloe Reed, who we had on the podcast last month. And along with Chloe, he's co-president of Live Oak International, and they are gearing up for their 35th edition of the horse show this year, which happens later this spring. Hi, Chester. How are you?
All is well. Better for speaking to you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, we're so happy you're here. So last month when we had Chloe on, it was great to get her perspective as a show jumper and someone who from the family who recently stepped up into a leadership role of the horse show. You know, I live here in Florida, so Live Oak is an event I look forward to every year from a spectator standpoint. It's just so unique in terms of what else is out there. And I think this year is really special, it being the 35th edition. So can you tell us a little bit more about what this event means to you personally?
Sure. This event is really a culmination of, you know, a village of people's work. It started in its roots as a little club driving show where they just had the cross country at Live Oak, and now has grown into an FEI international, you know, sport with people from coming from 17 nations. So it's really, we watched it go through its different stages of growth in a very organic manner. And in terms of what it means to me is it's really a way for my family and I to be able to give back to the sport that we've really loved over the years and that has been really good to us. In terms of opening the farm and opening our venue and developing our venue for excellence for horsemanship and sportsmanship.
Yeah, it's incredible. Again, as someone who comes from more of the like the show jumping and dressage worlds, like watching combined driving is just fascinating to me. And we'll get more into that. Our audience is mostly from that side of the sport. So I'm hoping you can explain a little bit for us.
Sure.
But you know, Live Oak, like you said, is an incredible venue. It's part of your family's property. This event only happens once a year. Can you tell us a little bit more about your family's ties to combined driving? I think it's very cool to hear how it grew from just a club event to international competition.
It's primarily a racing, breeding and training operation. We train about 60 horses every morning here in the heart of the training season. And I, at one stage in my life, thought, you know, I want to be a jockey. But unfortunately, at now 6 foot and just over 200 pounds, they weigh about 120 pounds soaking wet. So those dreams left me somewhere around 10 or 11 years old. My dad is also a guy who's sort of a bigger stature like me. And he wanted to have a riding horse. And when we were growing up, we had primarily quarter horses to kind of ride on the farm because the young thoroughbreds didn't really lend themselves to being family riding horses. And somebody had the idea, oh, it'd be great, let's get a Clydesdale. So bought one Clydesdale, and one Clydesdale was not very good at riding and was would want to buck you off. And of course, instead of finding another Clydesdale that was a gentle giant, amiable to riding, we, of course, broke it to drive and then got a cart and a carriage and drove around. And so that's something in my childhood that I grew up doing with my father. And then we ended up showing up to 6 and 8 sort of on the fair circuit around primarily the Midwest, but also showed horses at the Florida State Fair. And we had a lot of success, or I was personally able to have quite a bit of success into my sort of mid-teen years, driving 6 and 8. And then at some stage, my dad had said to me, maybe you should look at the sport of combined driving, because it's a little bit more sort of fast adrenaline pace thing. And we'd had a lot of success already at sort of my mid-teen years in the draft horses. And so I got involved in combined driving when I went off to boarding school in New Jersey, because there happened to be a driving person in the area and they did combined driving, and drove a single horse for a few years. And then from sort of 89 to 99, drove a pair of horses. And then 99 shifted over to a four in hand of horses.
Wow. And then the rest is history, because you went on to do it at a very high level.
Yeah, we keep striving for excellence and, you know, have had some success along the way. But that's not just me. That's the work of a bunch of wonderful horses and wonderful people around the program as well.
So the rules of combined driving, it reminds me a little bit of eventing, right? It's got three phases.
Exactly.
That marathon phase really, you know, resembles cross country, right? Like out on the terrain.
Exactly.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how it's formatted and judged?
Sure. Absolutely. So not unlike three-day event riding, combined driving is a three-day sport. The first day is dressage. It takes place in an arena that's, you know, roughly the size of a football arena, so 100 by 40 meters. It's judged subjectively by 5 judges, you know, on a test, doing roughly 16, 18 movements, and they give a score 1 to 10 based on the criteria of executing that test. But the criteria, very similar to ridden dressage, and the fundamentals of dressage are, you know, are basically the flat work or the fundamental basic training of the horse. So you should show that the horse should be able to do that. Then the second phase, more exciting day, is not subjective at all, just objective. And it is a cross-country marathon that is about an hour long, of which you spend about 35 minutes in 7 or 8 different obstacle zones. You're timed while you're in there. So it's not, in that way, it's different than three-day eventing. The winner doesn't have a score of 0, because you're assessed penalties for each minute you're in an obstacle. And
yeah, that's a long time.
Yeah. So you do 7 or 8 different obstacles, and then you have sort of a roads and tracks portion between them with the time allowed. And then the last day, because it's not very practical to jump over jumps with a horse, horses works, but the carriage doesn't work so well. So we have a cones test with, maybe oversimplifying it, but something like traffic cones that are set around 20 centimeters. So, you know, 3 inches on either side of the wheel, and there's a ball on the top, similar to a tennis ball. And you should drive a course, which is 20 numbered pairs of cones, similar to kind of a jumping course. And that's done within a time allowed. And then, of course, if you knock a ball down or you or over the time allowed, you're assessed penalties to do that.
Got it. And then, so then your scores from the three phases all go into like a final score.
Exactly.
Got
That's
it.
Correct.
Okay.
You figured it out. You passed the test. I think the roots, by the way, of the sport, not unlike the three-day eventing, come out of sort of the military work of a horse. Okay. So they would have to do the dressage phase, which would be more like pageantry, parades, things like that. And then they would have to do the cross-country phase, which much would be more like their battle work. And then they'd have to come back from their battle work and be able to do precise work in the city, whatever their job is, and come back from running full speed and continuing to be controllable and, of course, being fit and sound and things like that to do that job.
So what makes a good driving horse? Because what's so cool that you see at Live Oak is there's all different kinds of breeds who participate in this. It's not just what you think of. Like for me, you think a heavier set breed. Like there are some lovely movers, very athletic, lighter breeds that do it too.
Absolutely. And it's not in that way, not unlike maybe eventing. So, you know, you could event with the Connemara. And you can event with the thoroughbred, and you could probably event with the little heavier warm blood. Of course, as you get up in the levels, the, you know, stamina and speed and things like that are important. The one thing that's really unique or nice about driving on the international level is, you know, you see the Americans primarily, you know, driving the American Morgan horse, and you would see the Czech people driving the Clad Ruby horse, and the Austrians and the Hungarians driving the Lipizzaner horse, and the Portuguese driving the Lusitano horse and the Andalusian horse. And so you're seeing this just wide variety of horses from different places. There are some breeds that lend itself a little bit easier or better to the sport, i.e., you know, the European warm blood horse is a little bit more lent to the sport, I would say, across the three different disciplines. At the highest levels, but certainly at the single sport, you can find exceptions. The current world champion single horse is a Freiberger, which is a Swiss bred horse, kind of a Swiss warm bloody bred horse that's a little bit more on the cold blood side. That horse probably doesn't have, you know, the most exuberant gaits, but is a fantastic cross country horse, very good horse on Sunday, and technically fundamentally worked very well by its driver. And so it's neat in driving that you'll see everything. And then, of course, in driving, it's not only horses, but you also see ponies. So it's not just like the hunter-jumper space where you see children competing with ponies. You also see adults competing with ponies, maybe up to a 4 1/2 of ponies. And they vary from size from, you know, very small Shetland ponies to bigger ponies, sort of more on the Connemara size, that are nearly a horse.
That's so cool. I love that. I love the diversity that you get to see. So, Chester, do you plan to compete this year? Can you tell us more about your horses?
Sure. So I do. We've been preparing already. We were down at Terra Nova 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And the horses were really good. We had them out, just working on our group and our program for the season. And I couldn't be more pleased with them and what's going on with that group of horses. We, of course, have the World Equestrian Games in the end of August, are our focus and our sight and in our sights. But we also prioritize the American Championships every year. This year, we'll try to contest our 23rd National Championships at Live Oak. And of course, everybody says, oh, that must be a huge advantage, being able to, you know, drive it home and this kind of thing. And I always laugh. I'm like, it's an advantage. You should try it anytime. So we have a lot going on that week. Sometimes it's nicer from a competition standpoint to just go somewhere and focus solely on your job as a competitor and not somebody else who's having this issue or their alternator's broken on their pickup truck. And do I know the name of a garage, or their horse is looking for some specific variety of Tifton hay or whatever it is. So it's a lot of fun to organize Live Oak, but at the end of the week, Chloe and I have done a lot of work from sunup till well past sundown, being hosts and cleaning up and making sure that everything's ready for the next day, because our family is really, you know, believes in the in horsemanship and sportsmanship. At Live Oak, have sort of built that culture over 35 years, and this is really a place for horses and for horse people to have a wonderful weekend of a tournament of sport, and it's not a show. We're not showing dogs. This is a tournament, and it's about sport at the highest levels.
Absolutely. I mean, that was a beautiful way to put it. And as someone who's gotten to go and watch it over the years, it literally is one of the most fun horse shows I go to every year. It's so unique. There's nothing else like it. And your family's farm is just gorgeous. It's really nice to be out there and see all the horses doing what they're prepped and love to do. So I appreciate you guys putting it on.
Thank you so much. It's so much fun as well. Comes to mind some friends of mine who are jumping competitors and things like that. And they say, wow, the horses get off the truck at Live Oak and it's just all green grass and, there's not concrete everywhere and, lime rock roads and asphalt and all this sort of stuff. They get off the trailer and they're, looking around and sometimes the jumpers will get there because our big training field near the barns, they have a, segregated area for the jumpers. That field is about 16 acres. And so I had a dear friend who's an international jumping rider and they came and they said, my horses, after the first day, they were on a younger, I think 8-year-old mare that they were going to jump in the 2-star Grand Prix. And they said, phew, she was wild. And I think it was all the, seeing all the carriages and this kind of stuff. And so the next morning they got up at sort of daybreak and it was foggy. And they said, I'm going to take the horse out on the field when there's no driving horses and see if she's calmer. And then they said, my horse is wilder. And I said, well, I guess it doesn't have anything to do with the carriage. He said, no, I think my horse is actually anxious about, I thought my horse was nervous, but my horse is just excited to be on this, big, huge grass field that seems so primal and natural for a horse. And he said, I just kind of, got up off her back and just said, okay, let's go for a few rounds in the gallop and, do some things that are really natural. And he said it was so much fun to come from, being in these tiny little postage stamp rings where everything is controlled to just being in an environment where there's grass that horses can eat everywhere. And it's really an environment where horses thrive.
I love that. That's so cool. And so if you want to learn more information about Live Oak and you want to buy tickets, there's VIP tables for Marathon Day, which is really the day that is like the star day to be there, is to watch the marathon phase.
That makes me so happy that you say that. Chloe is always trying to tell me that Sunday, the day of the jumping Grand Prix, is always the day to be at Live Oak. But I'm always like, what are you crazy? There's usually 10,000 spectators on Saturday to come watch the cross country.
There's nothing else like it. It's so cool to see.
And so many horse people come to watch that have nothing to do with jumping or driving. I will see people who are pinhookers from the racing world and all of this stuff. They come and there's tailgating and people have tailgates and they're having picnics and cocktails and whatever. And it's just this huge social thing that's somehow very organically grown over the course of 35 years from probably one spectator to a real spectator event. So this event is about the spectator and the sponsor. And certainly we appreciate the athletes and the quality horses that come. But we made a choice many years ago that we were not going to be a horse show where we made our ring or made any income off of or tried to make income off of the competitor. We were going to try to see the sponsor and the spectator as our customer and try and put on a fantastic show of sport. And we've been able to do that successfully. And most of that has been from Chloe's mom, myself, learning what these different little community horse events have done throughout mm-hmm. Europe that have just, gone from a community horse show to now they're huge and sport at the top level. So we've kind of tried to take little pieces of what we've seen around the world and bring the best here to Ocala, to, the horse capital of the world.
Oh, I love that. That's so cool. So if you've ever been on the fence, listeners, and you're thinking about making a trip to Ocala, put Live Oak on your calendar. Tickets, VIP tables, tailgating spots, all of that info is available at liveoakinternational.com. And Chester, we just want to say thank you so much for joining us.
It's absolutely my pleasure to share my passion for horses and horse sport. It's super exciting. We also have a special treat for all the folks, the U.S. Army caisson horses from Arlington that I'm involved in the training of. They're going to come and do a color guard presentation during the days of Live Oak. And it'll be really exciting to see them as well. And, you know, what an honor it is to be around those horses and riders that commemorate the fallen soldiers in our most important national cemetery at Arlington.
Wow, that's amazing.
No slipping, no sliding, no problem. EcoGold secure saddle pads are engineered to keep your horse's back comfortable while keeping the saddle in place for a safe, competitive ride. They have an impact protection through the seat, and the ultra-thin flaps provide the rider with better communication and more stable riding position. Available in both English and Western styles. Shop the entire collection at ecogold.ca. So, Justine, I can't wait, because I've done a little bit of this before, but I heard you did like an equine dissection. Did you do the whole body? Did you do the legs? Like, I've done it a couple times and I can't wait to hear what you've done.
Ooh, yeah. I want to hear your experience too. But yeah, so this is the first time I've ever had the opportunity to do anything like this. And to back up a little bit, my body worker, her name is Gabby Hale. Her business is called Victory Equine Services, and she's based here in the Tampa area. She has a bunch of national certifications, but I know one of them is the NBCAAM Equine Body Working Certification. She's really big on continuing her education as she learns more how she can help horses. And part of that led her to meet this woman named Lori Mueller, who is a registered equine osteopath who's based in Texas. And her business is called Trinity Equine Services. And Lori hosts these equine dissections all across the country. Like, she travels all over doing this.
Oh, wow.
And Gabby last year traveled to Utah to attend one of these dissections and worked essentially with Lori, like as a partner in the physical work of doing the dissection, where she learned a ton. And they were able to bring that programming to Tampa, like our home where Gabby and I live, thanks to Dr. Kaylin Van Horn, who is a DVM, my vet. Her business is called Suncoast Equine Veterinary Services. They did it out of her farm. And for over three full days, they sold out the entire programming and had about maybe 25 people, I would guess off the top of my head, and people who came from states all over the country for this to learn from Lori, Gabby, and Dr. Van Horn. And I kind of knew what to expect, having talked about it with Gabby at several points, like when she's worked on Mikey. She's big on myofascia release and working on the soft tissue with Mikey and does an amazing job. And I remember her when she was telling me about what she learned when she did that dissection in Utah, that the dissection was really based on like looking at how the body works, obviously. But when we think about how we use horses as animals for performance and like thinking about true collection and how their bodies, like how they have to perform in order to achieve collection, and what some of our practices as humans in the sport, like the effects that they have on the body long term, that even, you know, stoic horses or what horses put up with from us, right? That we don't even realize, because the horses are sound and don't have behavioral problems, but the body doesn't lie when there are problems. So through that lens, I was just really fascinated about what could I learn. So I got there on the first day, and they had a horse that had been donated. They spent many months trying to find an appropriate horse, and all the attendees got a fact sheet about the horse. It came from Georgia, so it had like a couple hour haul to Tampa to come for the event. But he was a 5-year-old quarter horse gelding who had all kinds of problems, and his poor owner had spent basically his entire lifetime trying to help him, but he had like a fractured navicular bone, and eventually laminitis is what made her consider this humane euthanasia and thought that his body would be worth studying, which I think, like, I was just so taken aback by this owner who was there the entire time and watched and learned from the experience, that one, that they were brave and strong enough to go through with that, but that they even got to that place to make that decision to donate their horse to something.
But it probably gave them a bit of peace to know it was that bad when looking at, you can look at MRIs, you can look at x-rays, but right. when you actually look at stuff like that and you're like, wow, it was worse than even what the MRI and stuff shows. And because these horses are so stoic, I've
right.
done a couple where you're just like, wow, it's...
They live with more than we realize, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible.
Yeah, you break it down and you're like, it's half gone, that place. Like, it's amazing what they can, you know, stoically go through and what you see when you dissect a couple of them. When you know the history, that's the best part.
Totally. And she, I mean, she was incredible. Like, I do think it gave her the closure she needed, right?
Yeah.
And so... It was me. It was some body workers from Ocala. It was people from Georgia, people from other states, but a lot of professional folks who work in the equine space, trainers, body workers, vets. It was really cool.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the horse traveled to Tampa and then was humanely euthanized. And the first day, the dissection focused on organ removal, like looking at the organs. And yeah. we actually had an equine nutritionist who was there too. And so we spent a lot of time looking at the stomach and the intestine, which, I mean, it is incredible how much space just the size of the intestines of a horse. Like,
so long.
It's so long.
Like, no wonder the colic risk is so high. Like, it's amazing how they pack it all in there. Like,
yeah.
it just.
And if one little turn gets, yeah.
Exactly. It's like yeah. really incredible. Yeah. So, this horse never really had a history of ulcers, but it was, we found hindgut ulcers in him. Not a ton, but enough that you were like, oh, wow. Yeah. Like, that is a lesion on the inside.
Yeah.
You know? And. Like, it just is amazing because that's just, we know that that's a part of the body that's so hard for us to see. So it was really like, for me, that was like the first eye-opening moment of like, holy cow, like we're learning so much.
That wasn't even a concern, but it's still there.
But right. It was still there. And we cut his stomach open and we didn't really see the, you know, the glandular ulcers that you would in the stomach, which made sense.
Yeah. That's nice though.
And yeah, we learned about like, what does a healthy kidney look like? What does a healthy liver look like? Where the diaphragm sort of creates a barrier to the lungs and the heart from like the more gastrointestinal side of the body. It was really fascinating. And even just seeing how like the food from the stomach, like how grass and hay come through the stomach and like how it is digested and then becomes like at what point in the intestine does it become like ball formed that we see when they pass manure. It was like, it's not something I ever thought about until I was seeing it with my own eyes. Right.
Yeah.
And then the next day we focused on lungs and the face, but also the fascia. You know, this was something that was a big talking point for people in this discussion because most of them were body workers and vets and trying to understand like, what are the limits of what we can do to help them with soreness in the body, right? Because fascia is, I don't want to call it trending. Like, obviously, we know that fascia release is helpful and horses see relief from that. But it is kind of crazy to see it up close and see how it's,
yeah,
it's really a tougher.
It's not as black and white.
Exactly. And the material of it is like not like when you look at pictures of it, you think it's like this really flimsy webbing, but it's
no.
It's dense. It's thick. It really provides this like protective coating over the muscles and it connects the body, different parts of the body all together. Like it was really incredible to see.
And when it tightens up, it is like hard to break through.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Like it's an important part of connecting the whole body.
Yeah.
So that was another one that I thought was really interesting. People had questions about like some of the muscle groups, like near the hip where the muscle can be so thick, right? And how,
and you don't know how thick it is till you're like getting in. And
exactly.
Like,
it's crazy.
So thick. Even when you get down to the legs, that's a whole nother. Yes. We'll talk about it in a second.
And so how do you know that like physical touch, massage work, like, are we really making a difference when the muscle is that thick with our human hands?
Right. A lot of it is like the shockwave and stuff really gets in deep because they need it because it's that thick.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's what we were talking about. Like, what are the limits of relief?
What a human can do. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. And when like other therapies need to come in.
Yes.
Yeah, that's why Batman actually really likes the electro acupuncture.
Yeah,
because and it does all of penetrate. Them,
and so many animals and or horses and animals and our humans, everybody reacts differently. What my back will tolerate to want to be released, the next person couldn't, or vice versa. And so that's why it's so important to know it is so thick and it is so different base case by case. And oh, I mean, we love, I'm not that I love dissecting, but I love learning from the dissection. And every time we dissect, I swear I learn something more.
Oh, for sure. I mean, for me, like I was worried to look at the legs, just like it's going to give me trauma with Mikey thinking about what he went through, but
it almost gives you relief.
Right. Well, and that's what I was going to say. It's like looking at it's kind of amazing how those structures can take so much impact. Like we look at them and we think their legs are fragile, right? But like how all of those pieces work together under the skin is really incredible how it works. Well,
and we love it. Like we've done it. And so, and we've talked about it, like with the grooms and stuff like that. We're like, look, like there's so many different things. Like this is why this particular part of the leg, if you see a little bump, yes, we should be concerned. But if you see a big, you know, bump high up with all the muscle, like it's nothing, you know what I mean? It's not nothing, but it's something not to be particular. So it breaks down where the sensitive parts are and where we should be concerned and where is very, very sensitive and where's not, to be honest.
Right.
And so that's what we've really liked. We've done it with a couple grooms and our, you know, everything else. And I've been very fortunate. I've done a couple dissections through college and everything else, but you know, if you go down into the foot, like you understand how thick the foot is, but then how particular parts all work together. And you're like, of course, if one part goes wrong, it's frayed because it's attached to the next part. And so it's hard. And yeah, I mean,
no, yeah, it's fascinating. There was a lot of interesting discussion. So Lori talks a lot about biomechanics too, right? Like when you think of how we use the horses for performance. And something that stuck with me, she said how she hates how trainers use the word lift. We want them to lift their back. She's like, it's not when you look at how their back flexes with the muscle tone and top line, we don't actually want just the top line to lift. We want the core to elevate everything. And it shouldn't just be those muscles on top.
Their stomach needs to come up, not their back.
So she said using the term lift is confusing because what we think of is we just think we want the muscles along the top to work, but it really needs to come from the core and everything. And she said the appropriate term is elevate. Lift the entire body up off that back.
I thought about that you need the stomach to lift, but I never thought that the term lift is actually, you're correct. It's not correct.
Right. If you think about it and like seeing the muscles over the spine, like it made a lot of sense in that scenario. I was like, she's right. I see what she's saying.
No, that's really interesting.
And we even talked about like when we talk about horses that need to use the hind end, she's like, you know, I'm in a barn working on horses all the time and I'll hear the trainer from the arena shouting, just kick him forward. He needs to be more active behind, which is true. Right. But she's like, everyone thinks that means you got to pull him in and they've got to be balled up when the only thing that needs to change is that shift of balance needs to go slightly back onto the butt. And that is it. It has nothing to do with the head and the neck and right. It's just everything. They need to sit on their butt and then everything gets lighter. Right. And then you can do that quote unquote elevating. So it was just interesting to hear these terms that we hear every day, right. In our lessons at the barn, but looking at it from a scientific point of view and how it influences what muscle groups the horses are using and why. So, you know, Lori does these dissections all over the country. Like I said, they generally are 3 days. And it was cool to have 3 equine professionals, a traditional vet, Lori, the osteopath, and then Gabby, a body worker who's mostly in myofascial release. like their own experiences in what they see when they look at the body, like, cause they all had their own eye for things. And I just learned a ton. And Lori told
me, that's amazing.
Yeah. Lori told me she would love, you know, like she gets a lot of body workers who like to come to these events and she would love to cast a wider net. Cause like, what would happen if a horse show judge came? You know, would that change your perception on how we reward horses in the ring for this or that, right? Like if you could see how the muscle groups really work or how they really deteriorate, how could that change our education and what we reward in the show ring? And I thought that was like a really big, big picture question to be asking.
Following record-breaking crowds in 2025, the nation's only tournament to showcase both international combined driving and show jumping competition on the same stage takes place at Live Oak Stud from March 12th to March 15th, 2026. You won't want to miss the thrills of combined driving marathon and a show jumping Grand Prix. Tickets, tailgating, VIP tables, and more information are available at liveoakinternational.com.
All right, time for Rose and Thorn. Who wants to go first?
I can go.
Okay. What's up, Belly?
So my Rose is a fun one. My sister, my little sister who lives in Florida, is actually up staying with me for a month to hang out with her horses and to help me with the farm while Matt's, you know, in the depth of tax season.
Okay, that's fun.
Yeah. So it's exciting to have her here and to have an extra set of hands. Like even this morning, I was like, I don't even care if you don't help with stalls, just brush my horses. So
right.
I did stalls and she worked on her arms. She got pretty tired by the end. So that was fun. My thorn is that, yeah, I'm probably just the mud that's going to be coming. I'm not looking forward to it. Luckily, I bring my horses in when it's already dark outside, so I don't have to see how dirty they actually are. But yeah, I'm not ready. I'm not emotionally prepared for the mud.
I understand that.
Yeah.
Hopefully, maybe we'll get a little bit more snow and it will delay you, which is not what I'm hoping. And I won't as a, you know, Rose, but as a Rose for you, I feel like you'd want the snow.
Yeah, exactly. Bring back a little bit colder weather just for a bit longer.
So funny. All right. Well, I'm not sure. I'll go next because I'm not sure you guys are going to understand my thorn because I do feel like it is something not on the like ordinary, but I guess some of the schools do this like 100 day of school celebration and it's like super cool and the kids loved it. And I had plenty of advance notice. I'm not saying that, but Hudson's class needed to do a hat and I did not do my research. Like I 100% understand I did not do my research, that I should have like Googled it, but I was trying to be like resourceful. It was a couple weeks ago. It was right during like the snow was hitting here. So we were like stuck inside and I was like, we'll just find things around the house. This will be so fun. So Hudson found some buttons. I was like, great. We'll sew 100 because we read the instructions like 4 times. Cause even Doug's like, there's no way you're supposed to do this. You're supposed to like, they were going to count 100 of the items. And so I should have done stickers or something that he could have put on, like a cardboard hat. Instead, I was like, oh, I'm going to find like just a hat that's thin. He wanted to do buttons. Well, I didn't realize, you know, an 8-year-old can't sew on 100 buttons.
Oh, no.
So I sewed on 100 buttons. I mean, could sew on some and like he did help, but like at some point, honestly, it was like faster and he was getting like tired and he's like, I don't really understand like sewing on 100 buttons to a hat is actually like pretty tedious. So my thorn of this month was for any parent that has 100 days, like that you need to do something, just Google it first. Just Google all the different options you have. Don't go to your first choice because the 100, I will send you guys a picture. Abigail has like her friendship bracelets. I was running out of buttons. So I did our friendship bracelets and I did happy 100 days of school and spelled out the whole thing to use up all of the buttons.
There you go.
Oh my gosh.
So note to self, do some research before you sign up for your kids, like, you know, project that I did, basically.
So you're basically an expert now. You can sew any button back onto a coat.
I was always okay at sewing. That wasn't what I needed to test out in life. That was the problem. I didn't need to know how to sew. I needed to not know how to sew 100 buttons.
You'll have to share a picture in the Facebook group so everybody can see it. Yeah.
Oh, I will. I actually was very thankful for the Yanmar hat because it was super thin and it wasn't hard to sew into. So I used one of our Yanmar hats. Not going to lie. But yes, I will share it in the Facebook group and everybody can, hopefully other parents can, like, you know, understand the problems that went with it, basically. But he loved it and it was a good time. So, you know, but it was still a lot. And then my rose is, mine are not horse related this time, like at all. Last minute, Doug got a phone call from a friend and asked if we wanted to go to the Daytona 500. And we're not really like NASCAR fans or like racing fans, but I feel when you like get asked to go to something cool like that, like you can't turn it down if you're like around.
Oh yeah. So, it's still a fun thing to watch, even if you're, you know, cause yeah,
live events are live events. Sure. I think they're super cool. And so long story short, we'd never been to a NASCAR race. And so we went down and dropped our kids off in Aiken. That's why we were in Aiken, the front and the back half this past weekend. But we went down and we got to go for the night with friends to the Daytona 500.
That is pretty cool. I saw Doug's reels from it. Like, you guys had great seats. You were like right in the thick of it.
Yeah. And like, it was, you know, just friends that were like, we have extra seats. Everybody else canceled. Can you come? And we're like, absolutely. And so we were able to, we called and they're like, do you have reserves, you know, tie downs for the plane? And for $30, like that was us to park the plane overnight. And I was like, done. So we parked the plane right next to you. We were able to fly in next to the NASCAR track. We flew in Sunday morning and then walked to the hotel and our friends met us there. And then we went over and they had infield parking passes. Then we went over to their seats and stuff. And it was up high and it was so cool because the seats, the higher you went, you could see the whole track. So it was not as loud as well, which was nice, but it was so fun.
That's awesome. That sounds like super fun.
Yeah. So we were thrilled and then we just left the next day and yeah, it was super, super fun.
Awesome.
All right, Justine, what do you have?
Oh man. Sadly, I've got lots of thorns, guys.
Oh no.
Oh no.
Yeah. So my first thorn is this dang cough. And it's a long health story, but I think I told you on the last pod that I went with my family to ski in Breckenridge last month and we had a great time. But when I got home, like shortly after, I wasn't feeling great. And you know, you travel. I thought maybe I'd pick something up, but this time of year in Florida, for whatever reason, is like my high season for allergies.
Oh.
Like I'm a seasonal allergy sinus problem person. So I did like a telehealth appointment and they're like, it's probably a sinus infection. I was like negative flu, negative COVID tests, that kind of thing. So I did antibiotics for a sinus infection. And after like 10 days, I was not getting better whatsoever.
Oh no.
And like, and I was like riding horses and like living my life, just being like, I'll be fine one day. But then occasionally it would be like, why is it hard to breathe? And turns out I have pneumonia. First time pneumonia flyer.
No.
I guess you would consider it walking pneumonia since I'm not like, you know, bedridden ill.
Yeah, but still, but, yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. But now that I have the appropriate drugs, I feel a lot better. So I am on my way to being better. But, you know, that kind of puts a damper on things, sadly, because I was sick through my birthday. But what are you going to do? I guess I turned 38. It's not an exciting birthday anyway. But other than that, I would say my rose is that I've been having fun doing lots of horse things lately. I took Mikey down to Terra Nova. They had a schooling dressage show. And that is just like, if you guys have never been to Terra Nova, it's really worth the trip. It's just a beautiful place to ride. The footing is incredible. There's just so much to see and explore on your horse while you're there. And it's kind of far away from things, but the drive in is one of my favorites because you get to drive through like true old Florida, and it's beautiful. You drive through the Myakka River State Park, and it's just a beautiful, it's beautiful to take in the natural scenes of Florida, which are sadly disappearing because we're obsessed with letting people develop everything here. But Terra Nova is special for where it is. So I took Mikey to Terra Nova. I took him to another schooling show like north of us just to hack around. Like, I feel like we're getting pretty close, knock on wood, to maybe doing a second level test soon. So that's exciting. And I've been having fun with my lease horse, Cato. We talked about my beginner novice, my super slow beginner novice debut. I took him to a schooling jumper show recently, and we're like schooling 3 foot. So, and then I've taken him cross country schooling, and I'm hoping to take him out around novice shortly. So horse things are going good. So knock on wood, I hope it stays that way. So.
Yay.
That's gonna be so fun.
It's nice to have like, again, knock on wood, cross all the fingers, you know, hang whatever
goals and everything.
Spiritual thing. Don't come for me, horse gods. That everybody's sound, and it's nice to just like feel like I'm having fun and not stressed about the horses right now. So I'm going to ride this out for as long as it lasts.
There you go.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. But we do have a question from Emmy. She posted this in our Facebook group recently, and I thought it'd be a fun one for us to tackle in our mailbag. Emmy wants to know, does anyone else struggle with hoarding tack and other horse gear? I hope you both are raising your hands.
Everybody does.
I know. Yeah. I feel like this is 100% a universal horse girl problem. But Emmy says she rides, but doesn't own any horses right now and probably won't for a little while. But she has years and years worth of horse gear that she's collected. And she's like, should she just get rid of it? Like, just do a full Marie Kondo and just like donate and get the stuff out of her house. But like all of us, there's that little voice in the back of her head that's like, this is going to be useful one day if she keeps it. So what do you think? Like, yay, nay on should she get rid of it or should she hold on to it?
I'm all for like, if it's stuff that you don't have sentimental attachment to, sell it while the price is good. If the price isn't good, wait, because what if you need it one day? I mean, like, for example, like with Batman surgery, I sold one of my saddles that I've been sitting on. And I was like, I don't use this saddle. I probably don't need this saddle. Probably should sell this saddle. I was like, just leave it in the tack room. And I sold it so I could get, you know, some money for Batman surgery. So, you know, I think, I don't know, better to have it, not need. But if you can, if it's something you can easily replace, money's good.
I feel like that's good advice. And I think it depends on what it is. Cause like,
I think it depends on what it is. Like if you like saddles aren't going to, you know, after 15 years, you can't sell them for the same price if they were 5 years old. You know, like I learned that they can be brand new. And after 10 years, like they don't hold any kind of value. A lot of places won't take them, which I found that out.
Way.
Yeah.
Unless it's a Western saddle. Fun fact.
Yes. And then maybe, yes, Western. But English, like I had, you know, some not on a Save Our Saddles, but thankfully, you know, we had a client. They were like, oh, we went to sell it. And I was like, I didn't even know that was a thing after so many years.
Oh,
so after 10 years, a lot of these tack, like consignment places wouldn't take it. And I was like, oh, or they'd take it for like minimum value, even though it was brand new, never used, basically like used 10 times. And I was like, oh,
trends
well.
Change. You know what I mean? Yes. Like I have a lot of old horse boots that are still like the leather fleecy types that you like, they're just not trendy anymore.
So I would think those you kind of get rid of, but
yes.
I would say blankets, halters, lead ropes, bridles, bits, all of that. And I don't know if I shared this when we were doing the clean up when I cleaned up the ox barn, like our auxiliary barn and stuff, I found these big heavy duty totes that you can fit three blankets in. So I washed all of our blankets. I sent them. I went crazy last year. They hadn't been professionally washed in like 10, 15 years, to be honest. And I sent everything off. And then the ones that weren't, and you can label them. So every horse got a heavy, medium, and light with necks that were our horses, and they, in client horses, they did it. And then I put their label on it. And then the extras, I put in extra bags. So they stayed clean because they used to put them just in a baling twine and put them up, but they got disgusting and they were kind of gross. So to be honest, finding things to store them, like I would have put extra saddle pads in there, extra blankets, extra anything like coolers, whatever else, put them in those bags. They'll last another 10 years.
Yeah, I agree. I was going to say the same thing, Jess. Like, it depends on what it is. And if it's blankets, keep them. Saddle pads, yeah, keep them. Bits, keep them.
But good bridles, keep them.
Bridles, keep them. Just as long as you can store them in a place where they're not going to fall apart.
Or get moldy. Yeah.
Because that's the hard thing for me in Florida, right? Like, you can't get rid of the humidity, and where you store stuff, it just gets gross. But I don't know. I've never thrown out anything. I still have pony baker-sized...
Yeah.
Pony size, really bigger blankets. Like, I'm never going to own another pony, but I'm like, one day I might use it on something, so I won't get rid of it.
I won't get rid of it. And I'll have to text you guys the link for that. I found those. They're just heavy duty tote bags. And honestly, they can fit a light, heavy, and medium with necks all into one bag.
Interesting.
So in off season, I kept them in there. So we washed everybody. So now we just have to like keep up with the washing and not let them get disgusting. If they're super disgusting, I'll like send them back off. But now I could just like, Amazon has like the waterproofing detergent you can use. And I put a little bit of that in and I can wash my lights and mediums, no problem.
Interesting. Yeah. The other thing is riding clothes. Like when I, in college and like when I didn't have horses, I obviously kept all my breeches, but I feel like I would tell you to get rid of them now because the breeches change so quickly.
And they deteriorate. And the shirts.
Yeah. Like 10-year-old shirts, you're never going to wear those again. Like and that's a great place for like the Triad Equestrian or local consignment places. Like get rid of them now while they're still trendy and in decent shape and people can wear them. But if it's clothes you want to get rid of it now. And if you have a question for us and you want us to answer it on the air on one of our episodes, you can always send us an email at justine@heelsdownmedia.com or join our Facebook group, which is exclusive for our listeners. That's where Emmy posted this question. It's called the Heels Down Happy Hour Podcast Lounge. And if you want to hear more from us, you can check us out by visiting our website, heelsdownmag.com, for the latest news. And make sure you're following us on social media. We're at Heels Down Happy Hour on Instagram and at Heels Down Mag on Facebook and TikTok. And if you love our show, please give us a rate and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And we want to say thank you to our sponsors this month, Live Oak International, Eco Gold, and Hits. All right, guys, that's a wrap. Cheers.